Hello, and welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, president of the Hall of Fame, and I am delighted to say that this year, we're bringing you more episodes than ever, whether it be insights from champions and thinkers, or looking back at some of the sport's greatest stories. Along with Chris Bowers, I'm very excited to host some of these conversations in this new year. We'll start the season on the theme of tenacity, a value that we find time and time again the greatest to play the game all embody. Two players in particular represent the spirit of that word: Hall of Famers Hanna Manlikova and Pete Sampras. More on Pistol Pete later, but our story starts in 1980s Czechoslovakia. Chris Bowers reports.
Hanna Manlikova, the daughter of a Czechoslovak sprint champion, was the most beautiful stroke maker. Up to the age of 13, she was thought of in her home country as the natural running mate to Martina Navratilova, who was 5 years older. But after Navratilova's defection to the West in September 1975, Manlikova became the Czech national hero in women's tennis. She won the Australian Open in 1980, aged 18, and ended Chris Evert's 72-match winning streak on clay in the Roland Garros semi-finals in 1981, going on to take the title at just 19. When she reached the Wimbledon final 4 weeks later, she had firmly established herself at the top of women's tennis. Not that she was massively aware of it.
It's not at that moment what I thought about it. It's more what the other people thought about it, and the journalists who asked me about it, how amazing that is. I didn't see it that way that time. I always wanted to win. But when I look back now, when I am much older, I appreciate it so much more what I have achieved, you know, because it was quite amazing that I would be able to, I was in four Grand Slam finals in 1 year. So I appreciate it much more now than when I was younger, because I know how hard it is to do that. And I was able to do that.
Yet by the time the 23-year-old Manlikova arrived at the US Open in 1985, she seemed to have got stuck, failing to make inroads into the legendary duopoly at the top of women's tennis, Navratilova and Chris Evert. At one point, she went 2.5 years without winning a tournament. But then in early 1985, her Dutch coach, Betty Stover, brought in a hitting partner, Fritz Don, who helped work on Manlikova's fitness. When she beat Navratilova 7-6-6 love in Princeton in March, people took notice. But Manlikova still wasn't the finished article at that stage.
I've been playing pretty good the whole year. I didn't do very well at Wimbledon, but my fitness improved so much. I was working very, very hard with this fitness guy in Holland where I was living. And I put so much into it that I think I was too tired at French Open and Wimbledon. And then finally it paid off at US Open where I, from the first round, I really played very, very well and very strong. And then, you know, you go round by round and then suddenly you're in the quarterfinals and you start thinking, okay, maybe I can go further, I can do more.
But if the path through the early rounds had been straightforward, the road ahead now looked far more challenging. If Manlikova overcame her dangerous compatriot Helena Suková in the quarters, she was likely to have to face Evert and Navratilova in successive matches to take the title. Yet she never lacked confidence against her two greatest rivals.
You know, I always felt, and I was proud, when Martina was on this streak when nobody beat her, or Chrissy was, or especially Martina, I remember, I always felt going on the court that everybody is beatable. And that's what I always, when they ask me, I said, you know, I always believe that I can beat anybody. And that's how my mental, that's my mentality was like that. That's probably why I was able to do that, because I won't say respect, I did respect them as a players, but I knew my game is pretty, very, very close to them. It's just a matter of putting everything together that day. And I always believed anytime I step on the court that I could beat Martina and I can beat Chris. And I don't think the other players really didn't, because they lost 1-1 and she was beating everybody. They were beating them so easily. Everybody always knew what they get when they talk to me. I was always very honest. I got myself into hot water many times. But at least the people who appreciated, they knew, you know, that I was an honest person.
She beat Suková in a close match to set up a semi-final against the top-seeded Evert. Evert was not just the favourite. She'd beaten Mandlíková in the 1980 and 82 US Open finals. And when she took the first set 6-4, everyone expected another Evert-Navratilova final. But Mandlíková stuck to her net game, won the second set, and gave everything in the final set, including grazing her right arm in two falls onto the unforgiving Flushing Meadows concrete. Serving for the match at 5-3, her big serve and volleys held up, and she beat Evert to silence the New York crowd.
I beat Chrissy in the semifinals, where in three sets, playing very well, and, you know, start believing that maybe this time, for the third time in my career, being in the finals, I should basically be able to do it. I mean, this is going to be probably one of my last chances.
So to the final on Super Saturday, when the women's final was sandwiched between the two men's semi-finals. After McEnroe beat Villander in a five-setter, the women's final began in late afternoon. It was windy, humid and loud, the planes from LaGuardia Airport taking off right above the stadium. Mandlíková got off to a dream start, winning the first five games. But after missing three set points, she lost her way. Hannah has a very strong personal memory from the start of that final.
I remember going before the match and there was a radio playing in the locker room, and Tina Turner was playing We Don't Need Another Hero, and that stuck in my mind. I was singing that song all the way to the court. It kind of probably relaxed me, and I even was playing and I was still going, We Don't Need Another Hero was in my head. And then some, you know, I was playing so free. In like 15 minutes, I was 5 live up. And said, and then the music stopped in my head, and suddenly it was 5-all. So I said, okay, relax. There is a tiebreak coming up.
A marathon 11th game in which Mandlíková saved 8 break points turned the momentum back the Czech's way, and she went on to take that tiebreak. She knew Navratilova would come back at her, and she did, reeling off 5 straight games to take the final into a deciding set. If ever there was the need for Mandlíková to show the tenacity she wasn't known for, it was now. And when the final set went into a deciding tiebreak for only the second time in history, the need was even greater. Mandlíková won the first 6 points, hitting some stunning backhands, and although she faltered on her first 2 championship points, at 6-2 she lunged for a Navratilova passing shot, caught it off the sweet spot, and saw the crispest of volleys head beyond her opponent's reach for the title.
I fell on the court, threw the racket up in the air. You know, I remember going lunging to my backhand side because Martina went down the line with her backhand. I lunged, very difficult volley cross court, and then just relief. I just, it's indescribable feeling that, you know, you lift that cup for 3 minutes. That's what you work for all your life, lifting that cup for 3 minutes. You're holding it. And you're the best for that moment. For those 2 weeks, you are the best in the world, you know, and it feels like you own the world for 3 minutes. Then you give the cup back, next tournament starts, and you're not number one, you know, somebody else wins again. So unbelievable relief, great, happy feeling. And, you know, I still, this day, it's one of my best, it's my best Grand Slam I have ever won, yeah.
It had taken great tenacity to stick with Evert and Navratilova when, in both matches, it seemed Mandlíkova's chance had gone. The fitness work and the belief meant she could puncture the Evert-Navratilova dominance, really the only player to do so until Steffi Graf reached the top in 1987. Eleven years later, on that same stadium, Pete Sampras showed that he'd learnt lessons from a lack of tenacity. Sampras won the US Open in 1990 as a 19-year-old, somewhat out of the blue. 2 years later, he was still in the top 10, but hadn't added to that one major singles title. He made it to the final of the US Open, where he had an experience he says was one of the most important of his career.
Well, 92 US Open was a wake-up call for me. I won my Open at 19 in 1990, and was a little young and maybe not quite ready. And then went through the next 2 years just really trying to find my way. Like, what do I want from the game? Woke up in 92 against Edberg in the final. Slept well. Wasn't nervous. I was happy to get to the final. Like, I'm good. It's been a good 2 weeks. And I remember getting into the match, and Stefan didn't really play that well. I didn't play that well. You know, I lost the third set in a tough tiebreaker. In the fourth set, I kind of gave in a little bit. I didn't tank, but I didn't fight that hard. You know, I just went through the motions, lost the match. I'm good. You know, I got to the final. And for the next 2 to 3 months, it bothered me that I gave in a little bit. That, what do I want from this game? Like, what do I want? What am I willing to sacrifice and dedicate myself to this sport? I had to look myself in the mirror and be honest with myself that I gave in that match. And it bothered me. And I, from that match on, I had this incredible fear of losing. The feeling when you lose a final is, a major final is you just don't, it sucks. You know, it really does blow. And it rededicated my outlook, my mental outlook on the sport. And because I gave in, you know, I just didn't sit well with me. And from that point on, from 92, I would never let myself do that again, where I didn't fight hard. I just sort of went through the motions and, you know, I was happy to get to the final. And, you know, from that point on, I wasn't happy just getting to the final. I wanted to win these things. And so it completely changed my dedication, my work ethic, my focus, just everything that it takes to be the best in the world. Because up until that point, I didn't want to deal with the pressure. I don't want to deal with the expectations. I was good being ranked 6th in the world and like kind of on the back. I can put, you know, Boris in front or Andre. And I think that changed my whole outlook. Like, I want to be the man. I want to be the best in the world. I have the game. I have the athleticism to be the best in the world. And I'm copping out a little bit here. And so it just didn't sit well with me. And I think it took that sort of match to wake me up to what I want from the sport. And from that point on, I was like, never again.
Sampras's newfound dedication saw him win Wimbledon and the US Open the following year, 1993. But at the 94 US Open, having struggled before the event with an ankle ailment, he looked out of shape and forlorn in losing a five-setter to the diminutive Peruvian Jaime Izaga. By 1996, he was back at Flushing Meadows as the defending champion, but without a Grand Slam title that year, having lost before the finals at the Australian Open, Roland Garros and Wimbledon. Not that he seemed in any danger when he stepped out for his quarter-final against the 31st seed Alex Correia, a Spaniard whose only significant results had come on clay.
Going into the match, I felt fine. I went out there with a little low on fuel, didn't eat well. I was the timing of the match, just the whole thing just didn't work. And I get into this war with Alex, where he's, you know, hitting big, heavy topspins to my backhand. I'm trying to fight him off, and you know, the match is—it's not going well. You know, I'm not playing well. I'm just a dogfight.
Sampras won the first set, but lost the second 7-5 and the third by the same score. At this point, the champion started looking uncomfortable between points. This was where he had to be tenacious in the face of an ailing body. Into the fifth set, he seemed fine while the ball was in play, but the moment a point ended, his head hung and he frequently doubled over.
I'm just hanging on, not feeling too good, getting a little tired. And you know, when you get tired, you start reaching for things. So I reached for a Coke and I reached for a banana in the fifth set, thinking to get a little something in me. And you know, get into the tiebreaker, and like getting into the breaker, I was tired. I was dehydrated, but I wasn't sweating. You know, I was just stomach was cramping. I was feeling horrible.
But could the 22-year-old from Barcelona take advantage? There were no breaks of serve, so this epic contest, by now nearly 4 hours old, went into a final set tiebreak. After Correia thundered a forehand to level the breaker at one point all, Sampras felt his stomach rebelling.
You know, obviously, when you're not feeling well and you whatever is in your stomach, it's turned around and one all in the tiebreaker, I throw up and get a time delay warning, and okay, this is perseverance, okay? What do we got here?
As the players changed ends at 3-all, both were given a standing ovation. At 6-all, the fans were positively fervent. Correia had a match point at 7-6, but Sampras was able to lunge to his forehand volley to save it. An ace took Sampras to his second match point, only for Correia to double fault after 4 hours and 9 minutes. The Spaniard collapsed to his knees and, after a warm embrace with Sampras, stayed crying under his towel for several minutes. But for Sampras, he had shown the New York crowd something about him they'd never seen before.
You know, what saved me, quite honestly, was I wasn't playing it out. It was the tiebreaker, so it was going to be over sooner than later. a couple tricky points. I was down match point, hitting a good half volley and a good forehand volley, and hit a second serve ace at 6-all, and he double faulted to lose the match. And, you know, I felt relieved. I felt, you know, I showed everyone that there's some heart in there. Like, when you're not feeling well, playing well, you can always find a way. You can always persevere through anything. And up until that point, I don't think the New York crowd really saw that kind of grittiness in me. I was this kind of talented, lanky player that had this serve and this forehand, but, you know, he was willing to win ugly and, you know, and just showed physically that even though you're not feeling well, you can get through it. And all the years of sacrifice and dedication and hard work you put in off the court, you know, it pays off when you're in that situation where you're not feeling well or playing well, that you have that gut in there, that will in there, that you need to fight through it. And that I had to fight through because I hit the physical wall, just didn't have anything left, and was managed to squeak out that win and end up winning the tournament, actually.
Yes, Sampras beat Michael Chang to win the 1996 US Open, and in doing so, he'd not just shown tenacity, but a tenacity he'd learned from his defeat to Stefan Edberg in the 1992 final, a point he's happy to admit to now.
From 92, I probably would have lost that match, but I didn't want to lose that final, or I didn't want to lose that match. You know, I don't want to wake up the next day as not giving in that effort. So I think the transformation of me being two completely different athletes, and that's a perfect example of just changing your whole mentality in the sport and what's in there, and it's what's in your heart and your mind.
That U.S. Open title was Pete Sampras' eighth major, and he went on to win six more, making him the most successful men's singles champion at the time. My thanks to Chris Bowers in talking us through those two great stories, which epitomize what it takes to be a champion. And also to tennis writer and historian Joel Drucker, whose research helped put this podcast together. Now, later this month, I'll be bringing you conversations with several greats down under, live from the Australian Open. Stay tuned for more insights into what tenacity means, on court and off, straight from Melbourne. For more great stories and one-to-one conversations with some of the greatest players the game has ever seen, make sure you subscribe to the Tennis Worthy Podcast on Apple or Spotify. And to find out more about the podcast, including show notes and transcripts, head to tennisfame.com/podcast. I'm Patrick McEnroe. Thanks for listening.